Hey, everybody, you're listening to the San Diego Seculars, the podcast of the Humanist Association of San Diego for Monday, September 17th, 2012. Hi, everybody. My name is Jason Fry. I'm the president of the Humanist Association of San Diego. I have been really busy in my own personal life, and I apologize. I haven't had that much time to record podcasts. I actually have one, you know, sort of in the hopper, ready to go. And I've been receiving a lot of requests for podcasts, and that one will be out soon. But this one will be sort of a bare bones one just to get one out for you guys because you guys have been requesting it. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the news. I'm going to talk about the Benghazi, Libya, Arab Spring, Muslim Brotherhood situation. I just gave a lecture about that last night at the Joyce Beer Center. And then I'm going to talk about some of our upcoming things. So some top stories. In the news this last week, it came... some top stories. The iPhone 5 came out, and the iPhone is supposed to be longer, thinner, better. Apple said something to the effect that it will give your life meaning. And Paul Krugman said that it will actually slightly improve the GDP of the United States. On top of that, the millennials, according to a University of Texas Austin national survey by Professor Paula Poindexter, the millennials describe the news as garbage, lies, one-sided propaganda, and repetitive and boring. She also said, in the future, we may not have anybody consuming news. Poindexter also said in a press release that we can't continue to ignore the problem. The older generation is dying out. Who will be the role model encouraging future generations to be informed? And at Coffee and Conversation, we discussed this issue, and we don't know if she's completely correct. I think that we are a more news-driven culture at this point, specifically because it is all-encompassing. We have it in our smartphones, we have it in our emails, we have it in billboards, we have it on the car radio, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that the news, in fact, is going to, you know, be more widespread. But I think part of the problem about, you know, stations losing viewership and newspapers losing readership is the fact that they're drawn more and more towards entertainment and less towards fact-checking. For example, when James Holmes, the Batman shooter, did his little thing in Aurora, Colorado, the one news site put it out there that James Holmes had dyed his hair red to match Batman's arch nemesis, the Joker. And Jennifer Brower and I were sitting on Ocean Beach Pier right after the incident, and I was looking at the news on my phone, and I said, what the hell is this? So I talked to the nearest person, and I asked them, it was a couple, and I looked up, and I asked them both, I said, okay, I got a question for you guys. What color is the Joker's hair? And the man said, red. And the woman said, yeah, red. And I looked at her, I said, are you sure? And then she said, oh, wait, isn't it green? Of course, the Joker's hair is green. If it were some kind of obscure comic book character, maybe. But, you know, Batman is so deeply embedded in our culture to the point that we even have a Christmas Carol parody of Jingle Bells, Batman Smells, Robin Laid an Egg, Batmobile Lost Its Wheel, and Joker did a various number of activities depending on which version you learned on the school bus as a child. But we know the Joker. We know Batman. We've had a number of famous actors play the character, from Cesar Romero to Jack Nicholson to Heath Ledger. And so, I don't know. I think that as we retreat to a blogosphere world of infotainment, I think fact-checking is going to be their greatest sacrifice for convenience. And we need groups like ours, the Humanist Association, in our Coffee and Conversation to have some critical thought about the news. So, moving into separation of church and state for this last week, last couple weeks actually, Seth MacFarlane tweeted about the Democratic National Convention. MacFarlane tweeted that, I am very disappointed that the Democrats' platform did not mention Zeus, Ra, Tetzalcoatlico, Thor, or the Force. And that, of course, refers to when the Democratic National Committee decided to reintroduce God into the language of their platform when they excluded it this year. That, of course, and I'll play a clip for you in just a second. Okay, so as you heard, one of the people on the stage, I think it might be the co-chair or one of the higher up Democrats, had said, you got to let them do what they're going to do. Well, they didn't let them. Villaraigosa didn't let them do what they were going to do, he said. And the opinion of the chair, 2/3 majority voted for the reinsertion. And, of course, there's been backpedaling. But, you know, I think it said best when Kennedy was giving his 1960 September 12th speech at the Rice Hotel to the Ministers Association, when he was saying that religion was an obfuscatory issue, that poverty and suffering know no religious bounds. I think that that's kind of the position that the Democrats are taking, that God is irrelevant right now when we have real human problems to conquer. And the party leadership apparently decided that politics was more important than reason. And I don't know. What do you guys think of it? Email us, humanistsd@gmail.com, or check us out, Humanist Association of San Diego on Facebook, and send us a comment. Also, speaking of politics incorporating God, Mitt Romney is apparently, in several articles, is talking about how Mitt Romney is increasing the God talk. And Romney said to one news outlet, I will not take God out of my heart. I will not take God out of the public square. And I will not take it out of the platform of my party, which is wonderful if he were running for the presidency of his local Mormon congregation, or Mormon stake president, as they call it. But he's running to be the chief executive officer of the United States government, a position that, though it's often trafficked, it does not necessarily include religion. And honestly, if we're bringing religion into the mix, maybe something more important that Jesus said, like taking on poverty instead of taking on poor people. Okay, so moving on to a segment that I like to call Pernicious Piety. In Pernicious Piety, Dr. Pepper put out as their cover picture on their Facebook page one of a more simian creature looking like a chimpanzee. It says pre-Pepper. And then there's a man, a proto-man, who looks kind of slumped over, looking like Homo habilis, seeing a Dr. Pepper on a rock. It says Pepper Discovery. And then it shows an upright, fit young man walking away, drinking that Dr. Pepper. And it says post-Pepper with all his exuberant confidence. And there's been a significant amount of dislikes, apparently, to Dr. Pepper promoting, you know, apparently Dr. Pepper has his doctorate in evolutionary biology or something. But I don't know, I guess I'm a pepper, you're a pepper, when you like to evolve also. And, you know, I don't know. I'm just talking out my ass now. I'm just trying to get this done for you guys. I apologize that I've been so slacked on this. But moving forward, I like Facebook memes. I like pictures of fun things that Facebook puts out that people create. And one is a quote from Wanda Sykes. And Wanda Sykes is looking at the camera. This is probably one of her comedy specials. And this is attributed to Wanda Sykes. I don't have any citation on this, but I thought it sounded like something she would say. And it says, I'm a black gay woman. I think the only way to make the GOP hate me more is if I sent them a video of me rolling around on a pile of welfare checks. And on top of that, in our group, we talk a lot about LGBT news. And in LGBT news this last week, UCLA Law came out with a study saying that there has been no negative impact on military readiness, unit cohesion, recruitment, retention, or morale from the negation, nullification of don't ask, don't tell. So much like other countries have experienced, you don't face any real problems from having gay troops. In fact, you have probably increased unit cohesiveness as people are not completely nervous of being caught. But I shouldn't say that because I've never been in the military. I don't know that whole situation. But I assume that it would increase confidence and respect for one another. On top of that, the military is composed of younger people. And according to the Military Association of Atheists and Freethinkers, MAF, they put out some numbers saying something to the effect that 25% of military personnel are atheists, and it's probably because it's a bunch of young people. Young people in America tend to be more secularist and more atheists, and that's probably because I said earlier about the main proliferation of news, that now people can have all that information at their disposal to make better decisions. They also can connect the dots more readily. And I like that. I like the idea that it's also participatory by the blogosphere, but at the same time, we need educated voices out there to sort of be the bumpers on the tugboat to prevent us from crashing into the walls of ignorance and having our heuristics suck us into these voids of prejudice, bigotry, and these corruptions of our greater concepts and faculties of reason, these corruptions of our capacities for reason based upon emotion and tradition. And I guess we need free thinkers for that, because that's sort of the definition of free thought. The definition of free thought is seeing the world for the idea of the merits of ideas themselves and the ideas put through the test of reason, rather than giving a little extra weight to culture and convention. And we've been talking a little bit about politics off and on in our group, and I always stress that when we do, it's always nonpartisan, and we slam both Obama and Romney, and we say good things about both of them. And what I always try to emphasize is, I say, what you should realize is, if you like a candidate, they're the ones you need to check up on the most. And that's because you may be overlooking, or gladly overlooking, some terrible things that they're doing. For example, we can support and love Barack Obama for doing things such as pushing temporary amnesty for young immigrant children who didn't come over here of their own volition and who are upstanding members of the community, who graduated from high school, who, for all intents and purposes, they're Americans, and they have contributed, and letting them be here so they can work on, you know, becoming legal citizens of the United States, because children should not be punished first of all, and then secondly, if they're contributing to the system. We need Americans like them, especially because they work so hard in a system that would otherwise throw them out. And at the same time, a lot of liberals complain about George W. Bush for extraordinary rendition, illegal wiretaps, attacking extrajudiciously attacking other countries. Yet when Obama does it, the liberals, we typically don't have as much antipathy towards the current president than the former president for the same things. So when we're talking about, we should talk about politics, but we should avoid, when we're doing so, we should avoid lauding a particular party, and we should avoid trying to politicize issues, because things that politicians do matter. They matter because they direct and implement policy. And so we should be able to discuss these things. But at the same time, we should always stress that if you like someone, they're the ones you should pay attention to more for what they're doing that you probably would disagree with otherwise. And I think it's interesting. And when we talk about politics, it's always in a setting where we invite people from different slants, and that's what makes it more fun, because we argue and we can challenge each other's ideas on the virtue of ideas. And I like that. I like that because, you know, how do you know you're not full of shit unless someone who disagrees with you there sincerely and honestly can engage you, and then you can both point out where you're both full of shit. And I think that's cool. It's sort of an intellectual colonic, as it were. And on top of that, Joe Biden came out in LGBT news saying about federal marriage recognition that it's going to happen. So then also in politics, the Russian performance art group Pussy Riot, who was several of its members, three of its members were arrested for hooliganism with an intent to offend religion. Russian Prime Minister, former President, former Prime Minister, sort of musical chairs between him and Putin, Dmitry Medvedev came out saying that Pussy Riot will be freed from jail and that further jail time would be quote unquote unproductive. Moving into some science and health news. Science and health this week was interesting as well. A couple months back, ABC News did a study on quote-unquote pink slime. Pink slime is that mix of beef scraps and connective tissue put together with a glue-type solution involving water and ammonia. When they put it out there, Beef Products, Inc. says that they lost $1.2 billion in profits. So they're suing ABC News for $1.2 billion in profit losses. Something about the fact that when people found out that they had a choice between hamburger made with ammonia and hamburger not made with ammonia, I think they decided to go for the ammonia-less option. On top of that, Beef Products, Inc. is saying that their product is 100% beef. What do you guys think? Send us a Facebook comment. Humanist Association of San Diego on Facebook and humanistsd@gmail.com. On top of that, some scientists are coming out saying goodbye, pi. Mathematician Bob Palaise of Utah says pi has it wrong, that in most equations involving circles, it's always 2 pi. So a bunch of mathematicians have come up with a new figure, 2π6.28, and they call it tau. And so there's sort of a joke saying we celebrate March the 14th is Pi Day, and these mathematicians are now celebrating the 28th of June. So what do you think about that? The mathematicians came out saying the relation of the circumference to the radius is really the sacred number of the circle. And so that's where they're going. On top of this, a new study came out from the University of Basel in Switzerland saying there's hope for autism. 1% of children in America develop autism spectrum disorders, and it is connected to the gene Nerolegion 3, which is responsible for synaptic development. Well, after working with developing autism in mice and then doing some gene therapy, these scientists found that specific dysfunction neuronal circuits caused by autism can be reversed. And what they're thinking is the glutamate receptors are where they should target, and they think there are possible pharmacological benefits. So we'll see what's going to happen with that. And I don't know if it's, I don't think it's caused by thimerosal and vaccines. And at the same time, I don't think celebrities without medical degrees should be out there like Jennifer McCarthy and Jim Carrey out there talking that you should not vaccinate your child simply because of a threat of autism when they're not medical doctors themselves. And also the Wakefield study was debunked. And it's just this terrible idea that we're getting whooping cough and other horrible diseases back because of this antipathy towards vaccination. In the Muslim world, for example, in the hardline Islamist areas, they are having a rise in polio. The rise in polio is because the polio vaccine is apparently a Western conspiracy to make Muslim men infertile. And one of the problems with this is you have the rise of polio in certain areas where it was otherwise wiped out. And then, of course, you have the Hajj, where people from these Muslim areas all converge in Mecca and they go back home. And where we've stopped treating for polio long ago because, you know, it wasn't a factor any longer, you know, we have this danger now because of global travel of these diseases popping up. So I'm not saying that whooping cough is as serious or as long-lasting as polio, but we need to think about these things, and the fact of the matter is we have no conclusive proof at the moment that vaccines cause autism or sterility in Muslim and Arab men. So I guess the moral of the story is vaccinate and tell these stupid people to shut the fuck up or go get a medical degree and go research, research, research. You know, on the one hand, it's understandable where these fears come from because you want your child to grow up perfectly healthy, normal, and happy. But at the same time, if these ideas are completely unfounded, much like when polio first came out, it was sort of a summer illness, they originally attributed it to ice cream. And it's sort of like phrenology. You know, there's a lot of connections, but correlation is not necessarily causation. It can tell you certain factors. It can lead you to something, but much like we found that polio is not caused by ice cream, vaccinations probably don't cause autism. And even if they do, they cause autism in such a limited number of the population, have such great effects. And apparently, if it's a mercury issue, which I don't know if we still use mercury and thimerosal, all that type of thing to preserve vaccines, we could find a way around that. That's the thing. Instead of just avoiding vaccination, we need to work on it if it's causing a problem. And if it's not causing a problem, we need to encourage and maybe mandate every American to take a goddamn statistics class. Correlation is not causation. Okay, so last thing before I talk about the Benghazi embassy attack, I want to talk about something the AHA is doing. It's called the Ten Commitments. I like the Ten Commitments. It's superior to the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments is thou shalt not, thou shalt not. It is a requirement. It is a prohibition. It is an imposition. It is not participation. What the Ten Commitments are is they are a list of, it's a decalogue of commitments towards each other. And it's a commitment list in alphabetical order of the core principles of secular humanism. Those are altruism, caring for the world around us, critical thinking, empathy, ethical development, global awareness, human rights, peace and social justice, responsibility and service and participation. And what I think is interesting about this is when you have a commitment, it is contingent upon you and it's contingent upon your cohorts participating in it. You work as a community committed to something, whether you have a community of two or a community of 500. And if we hold each other to these ethical precepts that are at the foundation of all the major religions, they're not exclusive to those major religions, no matter what those religious types will tell you, but they are human ethics, humanism. I equate humanism not to atheism plus. I personally think the atheism plus thing is kind of stupid, because if it's about human need, human interest, we A, leave out the religious humanists, and B, we bring in an element that's not even necessary. Like Pierre Simon Laplace said to Napoleon, when Napoleon asked why Laplace had not included God in his treatise on the mechanics of the cosmos, Laplace said, "Sire, I didn't find that hypothesis necessary." So if we look at this, if we look at humanism as human ethics rather than atheism plus, we A, drop out that ontological absence, and we look towards that positive teleology, those positive goals, those positive ends. Humanism is a progressive, positive philosophy. It should have God being entirely irrelevant, because we're working on existent elements, human beings. What are we working on? We're working on working together, cooperation to better each other's lives. And I don't know, I've been also thinking a lot about religious humanism lately. My thought is, and this, both of these things kind of go for the commitments and religious humanism go to Freud and Nietzsche. And the commitment aspect, to go to Nietzsche, Nietzsche says that the dragon of God, this is in Thus Spake Zarathustra, the dragon of God will say, thou shalt not, but the lion, the step you're trying to reach after being the load-bearing, emotional suffering-bearing camel to metamorphose into the second level before you reach the Superman. He says that the lion, and God will say, thou shalt not. And the lion says, I will. It takes charge. It takes command. It takes responsibility. It takes responsibility to itself and to each other. As John Paul Sartre said, in existentialism is a humanism, that when we have this idea from Dostoevsky that Ivan Karamazov says that without God, all things are possible. Well, Sartre says, without God, there is no justification. You're responsible for everything that you do. And a lot of people find that chilling. The Ten Commitments emphasizes that responsibility. And then we look at Freud for this idea of religious humanism. And he says in both Future of an Illusion and Civilization and Its Discontents that it would be harmful to immediately remove religion from religious people, but there is a greater harm in maintaining it. And I'm thinking about this, especially because of the Benghazi thing I'm about to talk about. But looking at religious humanism, I personally don't know if religion is so much the problem as the coercive aspects of authoritative monotheism. And if it's not coercive, because what's the problem? Are we worried about some people having misappropriated ideas or bad scientific ideas, and they're proliferating them or they're speaking on them without any experience? If that's the case, there are a lot of atheists who don't know a lot about science necessarily either. But if the problem is physical coercion, violence, promoting anti-intellectualism for the sake of emotional fulfillment and promoting it on other people, if that's the problem, then we're not necessarily talking about scientific fact. We're talking about an entirely different animal. And if that's the case, which I hope it is, because if science were the only thing, scientific fact were the only thing holding back the gates of reason in people's brains, we have plenty of that happening now, and it's obviously failing. So if it's an ethical issue, and it's a feeling that our brains require consistency and require those fixed points when we're dealing with chaos, then if that's the case, then I think that religious humanism is something we should not necessarily ignore as humanists, but we should also work with. Because if they are outside of an ontological idea of there being a creator, if they are in the same boat as us, promoting the separation of church and state, if they're there promoting human dignity, human rights, not enforcing, if their religion has some kind of consternation attached to gay and lesbian people, if they're not promoting that for other people, if they're promoting being good, ethical people, and we can deal with the science later, but if they're there standing with us to stand against the coercion, then I think we should stand up with that, because they are good shining examples for their religions and for their religious adherence within their faiths. And if this is the case, then they can lead by example and pull people even closer to this consensual human set of basic humanistic agreements of ethics. And so looking at this, I don't necessarily see anything on these Ten Commitments that precludes religious humanists. If not, it has them stepping closer to what secular humanists agree to live their lives by, or live their lives by and typically agree with these statements because they're in line with that. And so we've been talking about these. We've been talking a lot about these. For the last 3 weeks, we've been talking about these every week. We talked about altruism 1 week. We talked about caring for the world around us the next week. And this week, we talked about critical thought. And we talked about how critical thought is absolutely necessary. It uses experience and reason to navigate and be flexible in situations rather than just buying into something by face value. It's your key inoculation against exploitation and ignorance. And so we promote these ideas. Next week, of course, we're going to talk about empathy. But the last 3 weeks, we talked about altruism, the biological components of altruism, how even if we decide to be individualists, our biology confounds being an absolute individualist in most cases, unless you're a sociopath, which those people are so few in number that it's negligible to talk about when we're talking about the generalness of humanity. So I want to talk a little bit about this thing that happened in Benghazi. And I'm going to make this sort of a 45-minute podcast today, just because I have been so busy, and I'm probably just going to post it without editing it or adding music in that, just because you guys have been asking for this. And then I will have an edited one from a couple weeks ago up, and then starting next week, I will be back with an edited and good one. And I'm sorry about the delay. So I'm going to give a brief overview of my lecture from yesterday. I typically do a third Sunday lecture at the Joyce Beers Community Center, and I was going to talk about, violence in the Abrahamic monotheisms in line with September 11th, the anniversary of September 11th. And what I ended up getting out of this is I thought that it was more important to focus on Islam this time, specifically because of the reaction to the 14-minute short film, The Innocence of Muslims. And I don't know. Sometimes I think things and I speak things that some people disagree with slightly or philosophically. I talk a little bit about religious humanism, and some people may disagree with that. But I like that. I like the disagreement. And I also don't like it in politics when we say, oh, this political person, this political personality, this candidate hung out or was associated with this person who we would otherwise disagree with, as though that is the entirety of their collective social circle. But I think Plutarch said it best when he wrote, "I don't need a friend who changes when I change and who nods when I nod. My shadow does that much better." And so last night I gave a talk, and I'm going to run through this real quick, on violence in the Abrahamic monotheisms. I gave a talk called Violence and Religion, The Threat of Violence in the Tapestry of the Abrahamic Monotheisms. And I spoke about violence as the Islamists' critique. I spoke about religion. I spoke about the history of religion leading to Abrahamic monotheism. I spoke about the violence within and the humanist response. And then we had a short discussion and we went to a Thai restaurant. And we love that Thai restaurant. This is a shout out to Bayuk. So the discussion questions, I want you guys to think about this if you're listening and post a comment on our Facebook page. Must the Abrahamic monotheisms be violent? What about moral oxygen, self-censorship versus the freedom of religion and your other thoughts? So the violence as the Islamists' critique. So some things that have happened, and this tends us to think about terrorism strictly as a Muslim thing, which it's not, but there are a lot of incidents where there are Muslim terrorists doing things in the name of the Quran, and I'll talk about that in a second, but here's several instances. We have the satanic verses. The real satanic verses happened when Muhammad didn't have a lot of power, and he was putting out some scriptural components that were more pluralistic, and when he gained more power, as you can tell, the Medinite verses in the Quran tended to be more peaceful, and the Mecca verses in the Quran were far more violent. So when Muhammad didn't have a lot of power, he was more pluralistic, more peaceful, but as he gained power, he became a vicious and evil megalomaniacal warlord. And there was a series of these more pluralistic verses in the Quranic literature that were more pluralistic. And later, it was when they received a lion's share of social power, when the warlord Muhammad rose up, they were destroyed. And it was said that Muhammad was influenced and inspired by Satan because they seemed to conflict with the rest of the Quran. It's also interesting in the Quran, it said that it's a completely consistent book, but there were so many versions floating around early on that Ali had them destroyed, had the alternate versions destroyed. So there you go with the Quran being absolutely perfect and consistent. But the Indian-born British author Sir Salman Rushdie did his fourth book inspired by something like this. It was a scribe of a Muhammad-like prophet, and he would slowly change the words that were being dictated to the point he would change entire paragraphs and pages, and the prophet would notice. And with this book, the Satanic Verses, Salman Rushdie received a fatwa from the Ayatollah Khomeini, and that fatwa is still on the books. The person who issued the fatwa has to be the person to rescind it, and he died, but they're still pursuing it. And it was really interesting. I saw a clip from a British talk show from, I think it was the early 90s, and it had Yousef Islam, Cat Stevens, that's who he became when he became Muslim, that was his given name. He essentially said that if he were in a country where the Sharia were in effect, and he saw Salman Rushdie sitting in a cafe, and that prohibition against blasphemy and apostasy was on the books there, he would kill him. And this is the type of thing we're against, that type of violence, and we need to talk about it. We need to move beyond saying that that Islam is all evil, and we need to definitely move beyond the converse side saying that Islam is all good. And Islam does have violence. Islam does have terrible things in it, and to say otherwise looks to the world at rose-colored glasses. But at the same time, we have to look at it in a more sophisticated manner, because not all Muslims are out there plotting to kill blonde-haired, blue-eyed babies and puppies. That's not true. Apparently, it's just a small number of Muslims. But at the same time, there are real issues to discuss about the moderates providing the moral oxygen for the extremists to operate under. And there are other considerations. It's not just stupidity. It's not just a book that's brimming with violence, even though the Quran, the Torah, and the Bible are all dripping with the toxic ooze that is the violence of the Abrahamic monotheisms, and I'll get to why that is in a moment. But more than 40 people were murdered because of this book that Salman Rushdie wrote. That type of violence is a critique. It just should send chills through you. And what happens is when people write something like this, no matter how well crafted or how tasteful, what ends up happening is those who murder people tend to receive the greatest sympathy. The religious leadership across the planet, the political leadership across the planet, Hillary Clinton did a really good job about this, unlike Obama, for example. She spoke, I'll talk about her in a second, but she condemned the violence more than the film. And with the Satanic Verses, we had the religious establishment coming out, not in defense of an author examining an issue. We had them coming out saying defaming religion of all kinds is the greater sin than murdering someone who, quote-unquote, defamed religion. And we need to think about these things. It seems to be a charge to yank us to reconsider our priorities. And then also we have September 11th, 2001. I don't want any comments. I don't want to hear about conspiracy theories, Thermite, you know, George W. Bush, et cetera, et cetera. George W. Bush tended to be the most, in these people's approximations, George W. Bush tended to be the most incompetent, ineffective president who had ever been born out of any head of state out of any country since the history of mankind. But this is the one thing that he did and did right, yada, yada, yada. But looking at this about the attacks in Virginia, New York, and Pennsylvania that left 2,996 dead and more than 6,000 directly injured, with tens of thousands more made sick. I want to look at this as an act done by the Salafist group Al-Qaeda in line with their leader Osama bin Laden's holy war against the United States. And it's important to think about September 11th because even more than the Salman Rushdie affair with the Satanic Verses, it was the motivation for many more people to relinquish respect for and or release their membership in organized religion. And I want to think about this. And was 9/11 a religious act? If we look at Why Politics Can't Be Freed from Religion by Ivan Stransky, he would say yes. Not that it was a necessarily Muslim thing to do it, but what this was it would be considered a socio-dynamogenic act to electrify a community. Those people who did it in certain circles were considered heroes. They were venerated. They were given a special status afforded to those who give great sacrifice to their religion. The people who did this had political and religious motivations for this. And in Islam, everything belongs to Allah, and you're essentially leasing your body, and you're giving it back. This was an act of sacrifice. This was a religious act. I'm not saying that all Muslims would do that. We have to talk about this. We have to differentiate this, because if we go to either side, we're both completely wrong. We're wrong when we say that Islam is completely evil. Islam is just a thing. There's a cultural Islam. There is a scriptural textual Islam. And if we have nonviolent Muslims, it doesn't mean that Islam is not violent. It's just not absolutely violent. And if we have violent Muslims, it contradicts they're violent because they receive the justification from their faith, and they're directed by their faith to target specific individuals through that justification of their faith. And there are extenuating circumstances such as economics and ethnocentrism. I'm going to talk about that in a minute. But if that's the case, then Islam is not devoid and bereft of violence. And the text is brimming with violence as well. It's not exclusively violence, no. If it were exclusively violence, I'm sure that majority of people who are Muslims would have rejected the text long, long ago. And these things are complicated, they're complex, and there are other things we have to concentrate on as well, not just that religion inspires people to do evil. Religion provides the moral oxygen to do evil. Religion directs the targets of evil actions. And I don't know. So 9/11 is sort of a turning point. And then beyond that, we have the Jyllands-Posten. Denmark sort of has a culture of satire, and it's good-natured ribbing at everyone's expense in the society, and that's how you kind of know you're a member of the society. There's a book about this called The Cartoons That Shook the World. But, of course, we had the 12 Muhammad cartoons in the Jyllands-Posten, And not all of them actually had Muhammad in them. It was just to do an image of Muhammad. Of course, the most incendiary one was the bomb turban Muhammad. There was one of a guy holding a stick figure with something falling on his head. There was one of a guy with a donkey walking through the desert. There was one of a guy writing on a chalkboard. There was one where he's looking conspicuously over his shoulder, nervously drawing something. So these were just explorations and led to, in protest, over 100 deaths and death threats for the cartoonists. And this led to greater debates to protect religious sentiments at the expense of censoring exploration of ideas. And then, of course, we have Ayaan Hirsi Ali and Theo van Gogh's submission in 2004, where Ayaan Hirsi Ali wanted to do a museum exhibition, and Theo van Gogh said, let's make a film. Let's make a movie. It was a 12-minute film, and it detailed violence in Islam, violence against women. And, of course, not all Muslims are violent against women, but some are. And the ones who are take their justification from the religious literature. And that's something we have to talk about. If we just look at it because we're afraid of upsetting someone's feelings, then it's going to continue. These are things that happen, and these are things we need to discuss because we promote civil rights and because the concerns of all human beings should be the concerns of ours as well, especially when people are being abused, when people are being violated, when people are being attacked. We should stand up and advocate for those who are under the focus of abuse, those who can't stand up for themselves. We do so as good human beings. And of course, this film submission was shown on national television in the Netherlands on August 29th, 2004. And just 3 months later, Theo van Gogh was killed. Actually, it was 2 months later because it was August anyway. But 2 months later, Theo van Gogh was killed by a Muslim extremist. Two good books on this I really recommend. One is Murder in Amsterdam, and the other is Ayaan Hirsi Ali's Infidel. On top of this, 2007, we had Lars Vilks, the Swedish artist, entering in some Muhammad images as Muhammad with a dog's body into a exhibition of dog art. He had assassination attempts as well, including a woman, a white Muslim woman from Pennsylvania by the name of Colleen R. LaRose. And luckily, he's still alive. But the fact of the matter is, we have to consider what's more important, human dignity or protecting the sentiments of people of a particular culture. I would say human dignity and the worth of a human life is more important than someone feeling upset over someone expressing an idea. And this essentially goes back to this whole idea that if you have an idea and you don't want it criticized, keep it to your goddamn self. But if you also put out the idea and you say it's the universal truth, well, you better believe people who disagree are going to step up. You know, you've got to have a brain yourself. And just because you set up an insular environment where you're at, if you're going to send it around the world, guess what? They're not subject to your laws. They're not subject to your religious law, especially if they're not Muslims. And then we have Molly Norris, who came out in 2010 with Everybody Draw Muhammad Day, and she had to go into hiding. Same with South Park. South Park, years and years ago, before the Yulens Posten did an image of Muhammad in their Religious Super Friends episode, and then we have South Park having Muhammad in a bear costume. The Simpsons had one of their chalkboard things that they do before their episodes, and Bart was writing on the chalkboard saying, South Park, we'd stand beside you if we weren't so scared. And then we have the issue of the Arab Spring. And this is sort of partially where this goes to, where it's sort of a political steam valve. The protest dealing with the Yulens Posten in certain countries were also that political steam valve. It was this idea that the governments were not doing so well with their people, and they point the blame somewhere else, and there's targeted rioting and targeted protests at the people who are not the enemy. And so in the Arab Spring, we've had governments violently overthrown. I'm not saying there aren't legitimate gripes, but violent overthrows of government. Come on, we're in the 21st century. And then the Muslim Brotherhood comes in. They take things over. And when you read about what happened, though they do some charity, they build schools, yada, 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 what happens when the Muslim Brotherhood moves into an area, the women end up wearing veils again. And or they end up wearing veils for the first time. And it becomes very conservative. And the thought is, do we really need God in constitutions like the Muslim Brotherhood tries to promote? And the answer is no. Actually, it's contrary to good government. It's contrary to good government because when you have God involved with the Constitution, what you're doing is you're setting up a government system based on something that is immutable and invariable as opposed to popular sovereignty. And you have specific specialists who decode these messages from these gods, and they end up tending to put in their own private particulars into the way things are. And that's absolutely unacceptable. And you know what? If you can go with this cultural relativistic idea saying, well, that's the way it is. Well, guess what? We know that when we have a Western sort of semi-social democracy model, we end up with greater economic freedom. We end up with a situation where women have positions of power, where gays and lesbians are not openly attacked and sanctioned by the government. We have situations where people have freedom of and from religion. In those situations, they typically step away from religion. The only reason it's so high in the United States is because in the 1970s, this massive social network that the Baptists had established in order to separate themselves from the modern world was capitalized upon to create religious impresarios and religious entrepreneur megalomaniacs. And what we have here is we have legitimate concerns over economics, legitimate concerns over the clamping of rights. But when you place a constitution in a religious set of laws, you throw human rights out the door. You get rid of human rights. You put the rights of the clergy above the rights of the people. As Diderot said, that man will not truly be free until the last king is strangled by the entrails of the last priest. We need to concentrate on popular sovereignty. And so these constitutions are written in the Sharia, which is the Muslim law. And this totally, especially with these recent uprisings, it reminds me of the French Revolution immediately after the Year of the Robespierre Terror. And the mob rule happened, and hopefully this will settle down and will probably lead to another dictator just as bad, if not worse, than Hosni Mubarak. And I don't know. I think that when Russia and China recently said we should not overthrow Bashar Assad without some kind of structured transition in place, I think that this is a sort of a symptom of proving Russia and China to be right. But at the same time, with this mob rule, the Robespierre Terror, even Thomas Paine was almost executed during it. There's no control. And even though these uprisings were just a handful of people, a few hundred people, the fact of the matter is they stormed foreign embassies. That is not acceptable. That is not acceptable for nations to maintain peace, for countries to allow their misanthropic mobs to go and destroy other countries' safe havens to carry out diplomacy. It's just insane. And we should condemn this. And they're doing so, and I think it's a total steam valve issue because this trailer had apparently been out there for a while, and bam, it's put out on September 11th, on the anniversary of the terrorist attacks in the United States. And these governments are not doing so well. And then even Mohamed Morsi, the president of Egypt, came out condemning, saying we need to prosecute the filmmakers. And it turns out that the filmmakers were not Americans. They were Coptic Christians from Egypt. And if you want to know what life is like in a primarily and predominantly Muslim country when you're of a religious minority, ask a Copt. Ask a Copt what it's like to be abused, to be murdered, to have your religious buildings destroyed by Muslim radical fundamentalists. And like I said, not all Muslims are like this, but we're not talking about all Muslims. We're talking about these radical fundamentalists, and we're talking about them. And I guess we are talking about the moral oxygen proliferated by the moderates. And so this film, Innocence of Muslims, was originally stated to be Desert Warrior, and it was done apparently by a man by the name of Nakula, using the pseudonym Sam Basile, which was apparently used by 15 other Egyptian Copts standing against the tyranny of Islam. The cast and crew of the film said that they were deceived, and it led to protests in dozens of countries against the United States. And our embassies in Libya and Tunisia were stormed, and now the black flag of the Islamists is flying over our embassy in Tunisia. We also lost U.S. Ambassador Chris Stevens, and the White House asked Google to take down the video, and Google refused. Good for them. I like that. And the fact of the matter is, we're vilifying those who, though it wasn't tactful, the film was really stupid. You know, it's not about artistic merit. It's about the right to have a stupid film. And they're saying things like, oh, the guy had some kind of tax fraud, or he was a meth dealer, or yada, yada, yada. Well, that waters down the true meaning of the story. This waters down the true message of what this is about. The true message of what this is about is the right to express versus the expectations of a particular culture to be insular from everyone else, to protect their faith as much as they think their faith needs to be protected. It's a cultural thing. Faith is a cultural thing. Cultures change. Cultures should have no real protections because they're just tentative agreements between people. But people should be protected. And this is the debate, whether Islam is a culture, Islam is a religion, is more important than someone's individual mind. And I would say no, the individual mind is far more important. And if Islam wasn't so shaky and was not so insecure, it would not bow to a shitty little film that looked like a community theater group did it with bad porn overdubbing. And this is a sign of how insecure Islam is. It's a sign of how wrong it is to submit yourself to a deity. That's what Islam means. Submission. Get off your knees. You're a human being. You're a member of the human race. You are not a member of a fraudulent, plagiarized cult, plagiarized from earlier sources. And, you know, you're a member of the human race. Stand up and act accordingly. You have inherent dignity. You have inherent worth. Stop resigning yourself from the human race and stop trying to take other people out of the human race when they're exploring the boundaries of their expression just because you don't like it. And if you talk about how Allah is all powerful, let him do his own goddamn dirty work. Save it for him. And if you think you need to be a soldier for Allah, like Nidal Hassan, the Fort Hood shooter, thought he used to be, maybe you should go seek some psychological counseling, you know? There are psychopharmaceuticals available to help you. But this is also precluding the fact that there are relevant reasons for violence and extremism. And, you know, I don't want to move beyond that whole idea and move beyond the shallowness of it. I want to talk about religion real quick, and I'm sure this is over 45 minutes now. But religion defined by two people, Emile Durkheim and Clifford Geertz, the sociologist and the anthropologist. Emile Durkheim in The Elementary Forms of Religious Life said, a religion is a solitary system of beliefs and practices relative to things sacred, that is to say, set apart, taboo, beliefs and practices which bring together those who adhere to them in a moral community known as a church. Clifford Geertz said, religion was a system of symbols that, when enacted by human beings, establishes powerful, pervasive, and long-lasting moods and motivations that make sense in terms of an idea of a general order of existence. And violence is not necessarily inherent in this. Durkheim did something interesting. He unseated theism from religion to include Theravadic Buddhism. And he focused it on human beings. This is what the sociologists do, the social scientists do with religion. They see it as a social effect, not as some kind of actual existent intercessory being. And that being probably doesn't exist. It probably doesn't exist to the point, you know, we hear these stupid things such as, oh, you can't absolutely say there isn't a God, so you're agnostic. Well, guess what? You have faith, so therefore you're saying you can't absolutely be sure there is a God because you have to have faith. You're an agnostic too. Since we're both agnostics, let's operate as though God doesn't exist till it proves itself. And so we look at this, the sociologists, the social scientists see religion for its social effects, and that's what we need to look at it as, because all those little faith things are personal proclivities. And if faith things are personal proclivities, well, shit, then we have to see it as what it is, a social phenomenon. And so I want to talk more about what I call the absolutist religions versus the pluralistic religions. The absolutist religions are more external. The pluralistic religions are more internal. We have the pluralistic religions, we have Taoism, Buddhism, Confucianism, Spiritualism, you know, et cetera, et cetera. In the West, we have this weird dichotomy that a man cannot serve two masters. Are you Christian? Are you Jewish? Are you Muslim? In China, you can be a good Confucianist at work, a good Taoist at home, and a good Buddhist in your community. And the idea is not about enforcing absolutes on everybody. It's more flexible, and it's more conducive to being tolerant or accepting of, I should say, I hate tolerance. Tolerance means that you're putting up with something. It's more accepting of divergences of thought and opinion. They even have this whole thing, you know, life in Buddhism is like a Pepsi bottle. You know, know, you unscrew the cap. If you haven't reached enlightenment, sorry, try again. In Buddhism, when you become a monk, you know, I'm not saying Buddhism is perfect. There are certain areas with authoritative Buddhism that are absolutely terrible. You know, the Dalai Lama, for example, though he's hoisted up as some kind of all-loving, compassionate greeting card man, he had a position of absolute dictator in Nepal, or Tibet, sorry, Tibet. Bleh. I'm not going to edit this, I'm just going to keep going. But we look at this, and they see that the whole point is to be in balance with everybody, as opposed to the absolutist external ones, Zoroastrianism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. They kind of led up to each other in that way, where Zoroastrianism started it off with an absolute good God that created everything, and the idea of ethics was attached to it when before... this whole construct, I'll get to that in just a second, when before it was consequences rather than intentions. And so we have Zoroastrianism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, which says there is one, you know, it went from, in Judaism, it went from a God figure trying to become the God of a tribe to Christianity, where it became a God for everybody. In Islam, it's everybody's God, whether or not you like it. And Islam is sort of Abrahamic monotheism perfected. And even within this, we have to realize this, that even within this, there is a divergence within the faith systems themselves. The Baylor Religious Survey done by Chris Baylor Religious Survey done by Chris Bader and Paul Frazee was put out in a book called America's Four Gods, What We Say About God and What It Says About Us. And in that, Bader and Frazee asked the question, how engaged is God and how judgmental is God? And they put together a category of four gods, and that's why they called America's Four Gods. The benevolent God, think the Morgan Freeman type of God, where God is non-judgmental but engaged, and God's evidence is presented in the existence of miracles. And it's said that tragedies are merely opportunities for God to express his love. God doesn't cause the plane to crash. God will save a couple people to show how compassionate he is. Then we have the authoritative God, which is Pat Robertson's, Jerry Falwell's destructive God, where God is both judgmental and engaged. God judges our intentions and acts upon it. And then we have the distant God. This God is the God of providence, mostly the God of the Jews and God of the agnostics, the God that doesn't require offerings or praise and rarely speaks of miracles or judgments in the afterlife. And this is sort of how David Sedaris wrote that the Greeks invented democracy and called it a day. This God invented the world and called it a day. You have the critical God, and it's not the God of the Jews for the most part, but it's sort of a Jewish mother God. It's a God that's highly judgmental, but simultaneously distant from the world. You know, you never call me anymore. How come you never write? You should wear a sweater. How come you're not seeing someone? That type of thing. And that God is slow to act now, but is still all-powerful and all-knowing. And that, quote-unquote, the critical God appears to hold a special place in the hearts of those who are the most in need of help, yet are denied assistance. You know, why isn't God acting? God will benefit us later. And there's a divergence in each set of faith. That's how people see God. And so we have to stop thinking of Islam as monolithic, because not only is it sectarian, but it's the same way for Christians, that different people in each sect, you know, there's a slant towards a particular authoritative nature or distant nature in that God. But there is divergence within the faiths themselves, and we have to think about that. It's contingent upon us, if we're being engaged by religious believers and adherents, that we should know what they're talking about. And if we don't believe, you know, regardless if we believe or not, these are human experiences and things other human beings cherish. And to survive and work together in a world, we need to learn about what other people think, and we also need to understand them through their eyes, and religion is a really good way to do that. It really helps with that. At the same time, it's not perfect. It doesn't mean we need to endorse the bullshit. It just means that we care about other people and seeing how they see their religion, which carries a lot over how they see the world, is an incredibly valuable tool to do so. And so we look at this, and why are people religious? And not only what is religion, but why are people religious? And people are religious, and I kind of think of it because of this. Two main reasons. And this is why science and scientific fact is such an improper tool. It's a different language entirely. People like relationships with forces that they think are out of their control. Because like Freud says in Future of an Illusion, even if you have no control over the option, at least you like to have an option of appeal. And we have no control over other people's behavior and no control over the environmental forces. But we would like to at least try to sway the hurricane by prayer, or at least have divine justice after we die. And so that's one main reason people are religious, to try to have influence. And on top of that, and every major religion, there's the axis mundi, the center of the world. In Abrahamic monotheisms, because of the way they developed out of the Mesopotamian construct, it's usually attached to a place. That's why you have sacred places. And these sacred places represent a way to have a relationship with your particular deity or demon. Demon not as an evil Christian demon, but demonology and extra deistic spiritual entity. And so the axis mundi is where the world came about, and the center of the world, and the place where, if you have a strong drive towards purity, how you can recapture purity once it's lost, and at the same time have a relationship with those fundamental forces. And I'll get to those fundamental forces in just a second. The second thing is consistency. Our brain is driven to strive to create order out of the world. Just look up change blindness. Look up the Necker, Necker cube. Look up optical illusions. Our brain puts order where there usually is none in order to make sense of it. You know, we have a blind spot in our eye from the occlusion of the optic nerve exiting the back of our eye. And do we see that blind spot? No, not unless we point it out. Our brain fills in the gaps. And on top of that, we like the consistency of tradition. We cling to things when we are afraid. When we find chaos too overbearing, we tend to cling towards things that we know. So why are people religious? Because we long for influence over an appeal to something, and we are driven towards consistency. And when we get afraid, we tend to cling to what we know. We cling to those fixed points. What are those fixed points? The axis mundi and the traditional aspects of cultural faith. And that's why we can talk about transitional fossils, punctuated evolution, Ernst Mayr, Stephen Jay Gould, Richard Dawkins, the selfish gene, until we're blue in the face. But unless we realize these things about the consistency aspect of the brain, and we realize the idea of the axis mundi, we probably won't get there. And some good books to read on this are Future of an Illusion, Civilization and Its Discontents, The Sacred and the Profane, Why God Won't Go Away, The Moral Landscape, and Religion and Human Evolution. Handful of good books for you there. And then we have authority. And the thing about these monotheisms is they're authoritative. And in Ivan Strensky's book, Why Politics Can't Be Freed from Religion, he talks about this. He talks about this distinction between potestas, physical coercive force, and auctoritas. Auctoritas is moral authority. And he says that you can't have politics without potestas. You can have politics without authority, moral authority. You can have politics with might makes right, but you can't have religion without moral authority. You can have religion without physical coercive force, such as Buddhism, please try again, but you can't have the Abrahamic monotheisms without physical coercive force, because it's either physical coercive force in this life or a physical coercive punishment in the afterlife. And so Strensky also speaks about the fact that religion's not all bad and it's not all good. In fact, I would say the best of religion is not endogenous to religion. It's built on a latticework of humanistic morality. And then we look at the fact that religion is a bad definition. I think religion personally covers three distinct areas. It covers the moral community, it covers a theistic orientation, and it covers the idea of your orientation to what you consider sacred. Those three things balance off of each other, and we can get by in a religious a religious context by getting rid of the God concept, but that's why I say religion is a bad definition, because there's three distinct elements that we're talking about, and one of them is not crucial. So therefore, we should start discussing it in terms of these things: sacristy orientation, theistic orientation, and moral community. And then if we do this, we can have a better definition of what it is, because then if we talk about, well, I'm of a particular religious faith and my God tells me what to do, well, tell me about your God figure and how your moral community expresses it. And why are you so driven to this? Some people have a more distant relationship with their God. Why do you find what the God says so sacred? And why do you find that God commands and doctrines so in line with what you consider sacred? And does the sacred, to go with Socrates, do the gods like things because they're holy, or are things holy because the gods like things? And so how this came about, how the Abrahamic monotheisms came about, we had, and this is in Robert Bella's book, Religion and Human Evolution from the Paleolithic to the Axial Age. He talked about tribal religion, archaic religion, and axial religion. And I'll say Abrahamic afterwards because it's sort of post-axial. But in the tribal context, what we received is an idea in which the entire community came together to appeal to those natural forces. In the archaic aspect, as we grew into a more sophisticated collective, we had people specializing in roles, and one role was no longer exclusively consanguinity, blood relation, kinship, but it was a more specialized leader role. And as that developed, we developed these concepts of gods in the Mediterranean aspect, and that ended up having tribal leaders mirroring tribal god leaders, and they would communicate with each other, and we would appeal towards that person who was the interlocutor between the god and the people, and the god was the interlocutor between the natural forces and the gods. And at that time, gods were attached to physical places, and you would have people competing to be the god of a people, and gods would get fired if they weren't working out. And it's interesting to note that people would pay tribute to the gods of a community rather than feel forced to adhere to those gods when they were awake. Those gods had limits of power, and those gods would appear to people and have conversations. Then we have the Axial Age, in which ethical consequences towards intention come into play, and we get the idea of more monotheistic elements. And then from that, we get the Abrahamic context. And this is a great book. You should get Religion and Human Evolution by Robert Bella. And so we look at the Abrahamic monotheisms, and they come from earlier sources, much, much earlier sources. And then from that, we get these Mesopotamian gods and these Babylonian Persian gods giving influence to Judaism. And that Judaism gave rise to Christianity. And then Christianity, of course, gave rise to Islam. And Islam looks at it as though Allah gave parts of the story that they felt that the people could handle. And that's their idea, that everybody else was just given just a piece of it. And the Muslims received the final thing, which is kind of solipsistic to think that if everybody received just a small piece, that people in the future wouldn't have a better piece. And at the same time, it said that the Islam came to lift the Arabs out of polytheism. And in his book, Why I'm Not a Muslim, Ibn Warraq writes, well, what's the matter with polytheism? And if monotheism is superior to polytheism, then by default, atheism would be superior to monotheism. And so we look at this, and the God of Abraham is sort of the Ugarit God, and there was sort of a cosmopolitan pantheon attached to the Ugaritic God, and the God had a wife and a consort, Astarte and Asherah, and the God had daughters and sons, including Baal and Yahweh. And El was a titular god, and also the former name for a king, a former title for a king. And so what you had is you had Abraham dealing with a god who wanted to be the god of his people. And it took several generations to, you know, Jeremiah, when Jeremiah wrestled that god figure, and that angel or god, you know, whatever, and that god finally got to be the god of Abraham, that foreskin fetishing god of Abraham. And then the Muslims take on these stories, change things around a little bit to make them suit themselves. And what really happened was you had sort of a rational deistic idea and a sort of a people of Hanuf, the Abrahamic tradition, rampant throughout the Arabic world. So it was relatively convenient that was happening, and it allowed for convenient transition to Muhammad's ideas of religion. And so we look at this, and we see the original stories and how they've influenced us. And I think they're more powerful, actually, because human beings have more power instead of just being a subject of God. We look at the story of Atrahasis, the creation of human beings, and the Enlil, the Sumerian tales. And Enlil, the sky god, came out saying, you know, to the gods who were arguing, you know. So here's the deal. So the gods were arguing that they were working too hard, they were toiling, and they wanted a solution. And so in a sense, we see this in the Genesis account of, let us create man in our own image and our own likeness. And Enki, the god of the earth, said, I have a plan. And he decided to, he killed one of the gods that was complaining the most about it, and from his blood created man from the dirt. And then man became the day laborer of the gods. We overpopulated, and to cull our numbers, the sky god Enlil decided that he would send a plague, and he started wiping us out. But one of Enki, the earth god's friends, Atrahasis, said, please tell your brother to stop this, and we will be a little more quiet. And so that happened. And when that happened, we started overpopulating again. And so Enlil, the god of the sky, said, well, shit, I can't get any sleep. These stupid day laborers are disrupting my life, and I don't enjoy being a god and not being able to get some shut-eye. So I'm going to send a flood. And so he prepared for the flood, and Enki was talking to his friend Atrahasis and said, well, you better build a boat, and you better put animals, and you better put people on the boat if you want to survive. And Enlil was furious until he discovered that the gods were starting to starve because the people were not providing food for them. And so it seemed as though we had a mutual and transactory relationship with the gods in the Sumerian context. And that went away further when we became complete subordinates to the god, and God didn't really need us except for entertainment. And so looking at this, we see how things change from a uniform appeal of the community to specialized sacerdotal authority. And then we saw how the God of Abraham wanted to be the clan God and extended outward, and it became a universal God. It became more nebulous. It lost more of its human qualities, and things went from focusing on the consequences of actions to the intent of actions. And as I said before, El was from a Ugaritic cosmopolitan pantheon. And so on top of that, the syncretism that came into play led to Islam, which I say Islam was probably the perfection of the Abrahamic monotheisms, where that God became all-powerful and all-intelligent, all blah, 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 99 attributes, you know, like, like, I guess you could say that Allah has 99 attributes and this bitch ain't one or something, I guess. But then we look, and it's not just strictly Islam, it's the entirety of the system. We have violence throughout the narrative. The narrative is based upon a series of violent acts to resolve conflicts and to perpetuate new situations. We start off with Cain. Why was Cain punished for murdering Abel? Well, I don't understand, because the whole thou shalt not kill came much, much later. There was no prohibition against it at the time. And then we move, God apparently made a mistake, wiped everyone out. And then we come to God asking Abraham to test him to kill his son. And since then, we get genital mutilation. Then we have Sodom and Gomorrah, which was essentially a pissing contest. It wasn't about homosexuality till the first century. And then we get the Egyptian, the Moses and his people with the command to eternally slaughter the Amalekites. And the Stuxnet virus that Israel put against Iran for its nuclear program, Bibi Netanyahu said, think Amalek. And so moving beyond this, we look further, and the source of a lot of Jewish holidays are murder and genocide. Look at Passover, the slaughter of the Egyptian children, even though that probably didn't happen because the Exodus probably didn't happen. We have Purim, which was a slaughter of Persians. We have Hanukkah, which was a slaughter of Greeks and religious moderates. We go to the whole point of Christianity, which is the crucifixion. And that's, if anything, a snuff idea. Then we come to the idea of the violence of hell. Then we come to punishment for children, wives, gays, dietary prohibitions, foreigners, intermarriage, blah, 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 blah. And violence, violence, violence. Then we go forward. We have crusades, the inquisitions, the intifadas. You know, I could go on till I'm blue in the face. And finally, we have eschatology, the day of judgment, when all non-believers and non-righteous shall be exterminated. And, you know, I mean, it's throughout the narrative. It's the glue that binds the thing, essentially. The dried blood and organs and mashed organs of the victims of Christianity, Islam, and Judaism are the glue, the mortar that binds the thing together. And so we look at Deuteronomy, Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 2, and Deuteronomy 7, 16, when it says, "When the Lord your God brings you into the land you are entering to possess and drives out before you many nations, and when the Lord your God has delivered them over to you and you have defeated them, then you must destroy them totally, make no treaty with them, and show them no mercy." Also, Deuteronomy 7:16, it says, "You shall devour all the peoples that the Lord your God is giving over to you, showing them no pity." And there's a good book on this called The Curse of Cain, Is Religion Killing Us? Lots of good books on this. And I look at this and it just strikes me as horrific. It's disgusting. We see these people as role models, Moses, etc., but they're really cautionary tales, if anything. They're cautionary tales. And it goes to things like, "Suffer ye not a witch to live." You know, that led to the murder of countless tens of thousands of women. And then we have these passages, these anti-abortion people, these anti-family planning choice people, who say that we need to protect life because in, what was it, Jeremiah or Judges or something, it said that "I knew ye in the womb." But there's scores of passages in the Bible where God not only commands his people to murder pregnant women and or take pregnant women, dash open their stomachs, and then dash the fetuses on the rocks. They also have a recipe called bad water, which induces an abortion. So if anything, God is, if you want to do tally for tally, number for number, God is more of an abortion fetishist than he is an abortion opponent. And so we have Islam, early Islam, the free thought tradition with Islam, secular Islam, and Islamism. And this is really important. And this is part of what I wanted to get to, and I think that we need to talk about. So early Islam, we have Muhammad, 570 through 632 CE, who was a brutal and effective warlord. He was more peaceful early on when he didn't have as much power, but then he became a brutal, genocidal asshole, and he murdered a lot of people. I'm not going to talk about the whole pedophilic aspects of Aisha. That's different. You know, this is about violence itself. And Muhammad came from what's called a Zendekist, rational deistic tribe of the Quraysh people, and he ended up creating his own band and then going against them. He formed a constitution with other tribes against the Quraysh people, including the Jews, and that was the first written constitution we have, called the Misak-e-Medina, the Constitution of Medina. And he had a constitution with the Jews, but then a couple years later, he had 600 Jews slaughtered, beheaded in one afternoon. And then when he came back to Mecca, you know, a pissed off son, you know, you have the prodigal son, but this takes it to a new level. When Muhammad came back to Mecca, what did he do? He destroyed the idols of other religions. He came in and basically destroyed other people's cultural, cherished cultural things. And these ideas are still out there today to destroy other people's culturally cherished items and artifacts, and then bitch and whine like a goddamn child till the sun sets that you felt slightly offended because we didn't agree that Muhammad was the greatest father, best friend, best husband, blah, 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 blah. Bullshit. Anyway, so he destroyed the artifacts and relics of other cultures. And you know, we can think about this, and there's some ethical things that have been said, but at the same time, it said Muhammad came and put in women's rights, but there was a Bedouin queen at the time who criticized Muhammad for covering his women and taking away their rights. And at the same time, there was, you know, we can talk about Aisha, but there was no primary, there's been such a deficit, a shocking deficit in Christianity, Judaism, and Islam of strong, feminine strong female leadership in proportionate roles to male leadership. We've gotten to that point today, but we still have to fight over it. We fight over it in the Catholic Church, but you know, other religious doctrines of Judaism and Christianity are stepping up to have more and more women leaders, actual recognized women leaders. But overall in Islam, that's not the case. You'll have predominantly male leadership, and that's part of our goal, is our role, and should be our goal as humanists to correct that. We also have sort of a hidden tradition of women in the free thought and humanist movement that needs to be discussed. And there's some good sources on it, like Annie Laurie Gaylor, for example, and Susan Jacoby, and Jennifer Michael Hecht. And also, if you want to know about some feminism and free thought and in atheism, humanism, look up Hypatia Bonner, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Lucretia Mott, lots and lots and lots of good people. The Grimke sisters, you should look up Emma Goldman, Margaret Sanger. I could go on and on and on and on. Look them up. Anyway, there has been a free thought tradition in the history of Islam as well. And it has been said that the Muslim world kept alive the writings of ancient Greece. But it was not a strong believing Muslim that did that. There has been cultural groups within the Muslim world that were free thinking. And there's a book called A Short History of Free Thought that came out in the early part of the 20th century by John McCannon Robinson. And I quote from it, of Al-Mahdi, who lived from 744 to 785. Al-Mahdi made war on the Ishmaelites, whom he regarded as atheists and who appear to have been connected with the Matalzalites, brethren of purity, destroying their book and causing others to be written against them. They were anti-Quranites, hardly atheists, but kind of an informal rationalism approaching to atheism and involving unbelief in the Quran and the Prophet seems to have spread considerably despite slaughter of many unbelievers by Al-Mahdi. And then we have Al-Mostar, who was a leading Matzalite. Matzalite, M-O-T-Z-A-L-I-T-E. The leading Matzalite said that had God left men to their natural liberty, the Arabians could have composed something not only equal but superior to the Quran in eloquence, method, and purity of language. And then finally, we have the Emir of the Unbelievers, Al-Mamun. 813 through 833 was his reign. And Al-Mamun was said that he put the state and intellect ahead of religion. Quote unquote, he even imprisoned some of the orthodox theologians who maintained that the Quran was not a created thing, though like certain persecutors of other faiths, he had expressly declared himself in favor of persuasion as against coercion. He was also the author of The Eternal Reason. Mamun was of all the caliphs the greatest promoter of science and culture, the chief encourager of the study of the translation of Greek literature, and despite his coercion of the theologians of the dogma of eternity of the Quran, tolerant enough to put a Christian at the head of a college at Damascus, declaring he chose him not for his religion but for his science. On top of that, today we have secular Islam, we have secular Judaism, secular Christianity, we have secular humanism, and secular Islam. There is an author, an open lesbian Indonesian author, she's a Canadian now, by the name of Irshad Manji. And Irshad Manji wrote a book called Allah, Love, and Liberty. She also produced and starred in a documentary called, I believe it's called Fear and Faith on PBS. And she talks about it. She says we need to bring back that free thought tradition of questioning the orthodoxy, promoting the dignity of human beings, and it's called ijtihad. And she said Islam came to conquer Arab tribalism, but in the end, Arab tribalism conquered Islam. And she also said supremacy is an act of war against the true pluralistic nature of ourselves. And I kind of disagree slightly with her Pollyannish ideas of Islam being corrupted, because I don't think it's corrupted. I think people just take it in different ways. So, you know, we get a lot of this whole, they don't have my religion. They don't speak for my religion. They're actually not speaking for the religion at all. They're liars, and they have the wrong view of the religion. Well, I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that they just take it differently, and they're the ones who have the bigger mouthpiece, you know, moderates go police your extremists. They're making you look bad. And at the same time, I heard on Religion and Ethics News Weekly, a weekly podcast that I listen to, that essentially people in the Muslim community are asking, how has it come to this that our community is seen to be so violent and awful? And, you know, I think that's a big part of it too. It's a mutual effort, not only from the outsiders who have to put up with their religious extremist, but the moderates in the faith who live their lives in humanistic ways and live their lives in secular ways and try to be a member of the community to put the richness of their culture in the mix, they suffer even greater. And so I think it's a mutual effort on our parts to work together for this. And then finally, we have Islamism. Islamism is often called Islamofascism, and it's a hyper-religiosity that has high expectations of deference to it from others. And this is the branch of Islam that causes a lot of the problems. This is the branch of Islam that does things like destroy the Bamiyan Buddhas in Afghanistan and destroy the Timbuktu Sufi mosque. And on top of that, we look at this, and there's an Islamist group up in Tunisia right now called Ansar Dine that, A, destroyed the Timbuktu mosque, and is also going around the country trying to start an Islamist state, and they are killing people for things like adultery. It's insane. And so there are reasons for violence. I want to get to this. This is near the end. I want to get to this. Reasons for violence. Violence is a response to modernity. The justification for the extremism is a response to modernity. People are afraid of the modernity. It's hard to handle it. And they want to get back to a nostalgized past that didn't necessarily actually occur. And when it happened, it was not good for everybody. But at the same time, people are afraid that they're going to be corrupted themselves. And, you know, maybe they have legitimate fears, but their legitimate fears are based upon limited solipsistic considerations. So we need to stand against this kind of fear of modernity and say you can, that everyone else is moving forward, and you can keep what is best about your tradition, and you should keep what's best about yourself, but at the same time realizing people are moving forward, even if that's your daughter or son. And also, this kind of extremism is a response to economic pressure. When the economy goes to shit, people cling more to religion. Like I said earlier, they cling to what's fixed and certain when they're scared. And that's understandable. It's highly understandable. People cling to what they're comfortable with and what they know when they're afraid. And so there's a study that came out recently from the Gallup organization on global religiosity. And it said that the poor are 17% more likely to be religious than the wealthy. And so we look at this, we look at the most poor, the states with the highest degrees of poverty, lowest education, lowest standard of living in the United States, they tend to be the most religious. There's an inverse relationship between religiosity and income level. It's because when you're secure, you're not clinging to those traditions, and you're more comfortable with people who are different than you. And you're more comfortable with change because you're secure in it. And then lastly, this extremism is a response to exclusion. Much like the Bracero programs of the 40s to the 60s in the United States, where we're saying, well, goddamn, all those illegal Mexicans came over here and they stayed. You know, well, Jesus, they liked it here. They put down roots. They made friends. You know, there are people as well. You would do the same thing. And of course, you want your family to come be part of it. Same thing happened in Europe. The reason homegrown terrorism happens with the second and third generation, not the first generation, when it comes to Muslims, is because of the ethnocentrism in Europe and the fact of the matter that they were not completely welcomed into the society. They were seen as lower. They were seen as the other. And when that happened, you ended up with people taking on an exaggerated version of their desired identity or their identity they thought they identified with. And that's what it is. And at the same time, it's all justified with an exemplary place in the scripture itself. Sacrifice is seen as this outstanding action to be celebrated, and to not only celebrate it yourself, but to celebrate others who have done it before you. So that's one reason suicide bombing, when it comes from a Muslim context, is always a religious act, because it's an act of giving things back to Allah and giving to the Ummah, the community. And, you know, it's like that also when we have Christian terrorists who go in and shoot up an abortion clinic and then shoot themselves. That's a religious act as well. And we have to think about these things. And I think a good inoculation against it is secularity and religious humanism at first to wean someone off, like trying to quit smoking cold turkey. It's probably not going to happen. And at the same time, looking at this whole idea of science and scientific language, well, we've had it out there for a long time, and it hasn't had as great of an effect as it probably would have if that were what was at the heart of the matter. And if it's about tradition, comfort, and about consistency, well, let's tackle it like that. So then violence in Islam, the last point on this. There are 1.6 billion Muslims, and one thing we have to remember is only 20% of the Muslim world is Arab. There's a whole breadth of different ideas on Islam, different sects. There are Sunnis, there are Shiites, there are Alawites, there are Al-Ahmadiyyas, there are Sufis, Salafists, etc., etc. And most people think of Sunnis when they think of a Muslim or Shiites, because they're the two biggest groups. But we also have the Al-Ahmadiyyas. They're sort of seen as a cult. We have the Salafist, which is sort of a concentrated Sunnism, and that's the really violent one we're talking about when we're talking about Al-Qaeda, the Muslim brother. We're talking about the Salafists, those ones, those fundamentalists, those Islamists who try to impose the Sharia on other people. And they're a minority in Islam, but they do receive community support. And that's part of the whole thing. If we wanted to really fight a war on terror, well, we would, you know, exchange what the terrorists are paying them over in those areas, the tribal leaders, and we would build roads and schools. And if that were the case, we would probably win out. And at the same time, in the 1970s, a lot of these radical imams were sent out to poor areas to do just that, to proliferate these radical fundamentalist ideologies. And now we're dealing with it today. You know, why the hell are we not putting out religious humanists and putting them into new areas to build infrastructure and creating a more tentative way to work with the world, a better way for people to get along, a more peaceful way, because there are peaceful Muslims. Peace is possible in Islam, but it's hard to come by because of the radicals. And at the same time, we shouldn't be pushing for Islam. We should be pushing for secular humanism, because we all don't agree that there is a God. And even those who agree that there is a God, they even disagree more what God it is. So before we can prove there is a God, we should maybe refrain from submitting to it. And so, looking at this, we also have the Alawites, and they are also considered semi-cult of Islam. And we look at Syria, and it's talked about there's a riots and civil war for economic reasons. Well, the Alawites are not a highly popular group. The majority of the population in Syria are Sunni, and lo and behold, Bashar Assad's family are Alawites. And you have this Sunni-type Muslim Brotherhood Arab Spring happening, and I think that that may just be one of the factors. And on top of that, we have the Sharia, which means the path to water. And the Sharia is based in different sources, the Surah, Sunnahs, Ijma, and Ijtihad. And we need to look at that, and we need to say, well, if you're trying to live as a religious person, that you can, you know, potentially guide yourself by that. But when you're living with other people, we need a modern, secular, popular, sovereign way to look at things and to guide ourselves by in a legal, jurisprudential context. And in that, when the Sharia comes to conflict with civil law, then civil law must support the Sharia. Otherwise, the civil law will be subordinate to religious doctrine, which is always immutable and invariable. And as I said, we have about this whole socio-dynamogenic forces, jihad and terrorism. Well, moderate Muslims say jihad is the internal struggle, but hardcore Muslims, fundamentalists, these Salafists, say that jihad is the sixth pillar of Islam, and it must be carried out. And the thing about it is, in areas, in constructs where that happens, it carries a socio-dynamogenic force, and it returns to Allah what is His, and it provides a moralizing element to electrify the community. And then lastly, this is also a response to Western ethnocentrism and exclusion. We didn't make enough of a place to welcome a lot of Muslims into Western society, so we're dealing with that. Because, you know, Western culture has up until, you know, we're dealing with it now, we're better now, but you gotta admit, Western culture has had its share of ethnocentrism, racism. We haven't been perfect, but we're getting over those problems. We've had our problems with misogyny, heterocentrism and homophobia, and these ideas of exclusive dichotomous genders for transgendered people. And we're getting over it. We're working on it. And we're learning the benefits, the fruits of that type of pluralistic society, you know, gained by having that central core of universal humanistic ethics. And so these were just some thoughts to think about on this. And there's a couple good books. Read Who Speaks for Islam from Gallup, What a Billion Muslims Really Think. And also read Ibn Warraq's Why I'm Not a Muslim. We should learn both sides of the issue. We should learn it in its full depth and complexity, not just because we want to bitch about things, but because it's coming from people and we care about people and it's part of the human race and the human experience, and that's something valuable in and of itself. And so just some last thoughts on this, of what happens. And that the Quran is not exclusively a book of peace. There's violence with it. And I want to quote from the Quran a bit as I finish. But on the non-believers, the Quran in book 4, verse 89 says, They but wish ye should reject faith as they do, and thus be on the same footing as they. But take not friends from their ranks until they flee in the way of Allah from what is forbidden. But if they turn renegade, seize them and slay them wherever you find them. Also in the hadith of Bukhari 83:37, it said, Allah's apostle never killed anyone except for one of the three following situations. Anyone who killed someone unjustly was killed in Qisas. A married person who committed illegal sexual intercourse, and a man who fought against Allah and his apostle and deserted Islam and became an apostate. And then Bukhari 84:64-65 said, Allah's apostate said, during the last days there will appear some young foolish people who will say the best words, but their faith will not go beyond their throats, and they will find no faith, and will go out from or leave their religion as an arrow goes of the game. So whenever you find them, kill them, for whoever kills them shall have reward on the day of resurrection. Keep in mind the Sharia is based both in Hadith and Quran. And so looking at this in application, we have Harakat al-Muqawama al-Islamiyya, otherwise known as Hamas, the Islamic Resistance Movement. And in the Hamas Charter, in Islamism in Action, on the PLO, the Palestinian Authority, Palestinian Liberation Organization, and their charter talks about a pluralistic Palestine, but Hamas is about Islamic Palestine. And in Article 7 and 8, it says that jihad, its path and death for the cause of Allah, is its supreme belief. The Prophet, prayer and peace be upon him, said, the time will not come, he's talking about the last day, until Muslims fight the Jews and kill them, until the Jews hide behind the rocks and trees, which will cry, O Muslim, there is a Jew hiding behind me, come and kill him. This will not apply to the Garkat, which is a Jewish tree. And then that was also cited from the Bukhari Hadiths, and that was the Hamas Charter, 1988 Hamas Charter. You should look it up. And then lastly, on nonviolence, this is sort of a rehash and a quasi-plagiarism of a rabbinical text that Muhammad used about murder and peace. And this one's often attributed to Muhammad, though it was said much, much earlier in a rabbinical source. But it said, because of that, we decreed upon the children of Israel that whoever kills a soul, unless for a soul or for corruption done in the land, it is as if he had slain mankind entirely. And whoever saves one, it is as if he'd saved mankind entirely. And our messengers had certainly come to them with clear proofs. Then indeed, many of them, even after that, throughout the land were transgressors. And that was book 5, verse 32. But where I go further with this is we have to look at the context. And looking at verse 33 and 34 of book 5, beyond those who save a life save the entire world. Indeed, the penalty for those who wage war against Allah and his messenger and strive upon earth to cause corruption is none but that they be killed or crucified, or that their hands and feet be cut off from opposite sides, or that they be exiled from the land. That is from them a disgrace in this world, and for them in hereafter is a great punishment, except for those who return repenting before you apprehend them and know that Allah is forgiving and merciful. And lastly, this is from 535, 536, and 537. Excuse me. O you who have believed, fear Allah and seek the means of nearness to Him and strive in His cause that ye may succeed. Indeed, those who disbelieve, if they should have all that is in this earth and the like of it, which by which to ransom themselves from the punishment of the day of resurrection, will not be accepted from them, and for them is a painful punishment. They will wish to get out of the fire, but never are they to emerge therefrom, and for them is enduring punishment. I apologize, my throat's kind of dry. And lastly, book 5, verse 40 says, do you not know that to Allah belongs the dominion of the heavens and the earth? He punishes whom He wills and forgives whom He wills, and Allah is over all things competent. And so I say that because not all Muslims are violent, and much like the other verses in the Bible and the Torah, which are overlooked by the most Jews and Christians, who would find other opportunities and other such punishments for behavior and other such actions abhorrent and criminal, most Muslims do the same thing. But those who do cite the Quran, they justify it in the Quran. And I hope we can talk about this, and I hope that this can encourage greater dialogue. And, you know, the thing about humanistic ethics is it's applicable to all, and what's best about religion, those elements, altruism, compassion, taking care of each other, that's at the core of humanistic ethics. It's not endogenous to religion, and sort of humanism filters out all the bullshit. It focuses on the needs of humans in the here and now. And at the same time, one thing about humanism that needs to be extended is that no one is inviolable to criticism, and humanists uphold that as a key value, at least hopefully, to think that expression of ideas, and I'm not talking about a necessary abuse of private individuals, but you know, no, there should be no figure so sacred you can't just draw a picture and make a joke about them. If they're celebrated, they're there to be examined and to use as examples, or to ignore, or to try to, you know, push down and tarnish. It's up to you. But the important thing is it is up to you, and you have the right to do so. And I keep saying this. This is sort of my humanist quote that I hope I'm remembered for. Humanism is what happened when we learned that not only were we the author of history, but we hold the pen. And it's that level of ability to help at least try to pursue achieving something in our future, and realizing that everything of the past was the responsibility of our ancestors that we inherited, and we are not necessarily exclusively bound to it, because we do hold the pen to write a brand new future. And so, lastly, I want to leave with a quote from Hillary Clinton on this before I talk about some upcoming things that we have in our group. And I think they're pretty good upcoming things, and I hope that you'll like them. And Hillary Clinton said it really well. When other people were saying we need to arrest the film producers, Hillary Clinton came out as the voice of reason. Secretary Clinton came out as the voice of reason. She said, when Christians are subject to insults to their faith, and that certainly happens, we expect them not to resort to violence. When Hindus or Buddhists are subject to insults to their faiths, and that certainly happens, we expect them not to resort to violence. The same goes for all faiths, including Islam. We can pledge whatever one person speaks out in ignorance and bigotry, we can pledge that whenever one person speaks out in ignorance and bigotry, 10 voices will answer. They will answer resoundingly against the offense and the insult, answering ignorance with enlightenment, answering hatred with understanding, answering darkness with light. And I like that. I absolutely like that. I appreciate that. I think that's the right way to go. And she also came out saying that you do not honor your faith by committing acts of violence. And I think that needs to be repeated over and over again, that you do not honor your faith by acts of violence. In fact, you do quite the opposite. And I don't know. There's a couple of things I want to bring up lastly. And we have some cool things coming up. this Tuesday, tomorrow actually, we're going to be discussing Nietzsche's book, The Antichrist. Later this month, we're having pizza with Ray Comfort, the banana man, as people call him. But, you know, it'll be interesting to have lunch with him, the person who speaks that intelligent design happened, the intelligent design proponent in October. We are reading Prisoner for Blasphemy and the Freethinker's textbook. We are having a Christian minister come to tell us what's wrong with religion. And November, we are doing dialogues concerning natural religion and reading Leviathan. And we are doing our annual logical fallacy clinic and doing a Thanksgiving event. In December, we're reading Why I'm Not a Christian and selected readings from Robert Greene Ingersoll. We are doing Human Light and having our annual membership meeting. And then finally, we do weekly coffee and conversation. That's at the Tea Deli at Bamboo Lounge, 1469 University, every Saturday at 6 o'clock. This is an original two-hour show, and it's a lot of fun, discussion group presentation. And we recently started promoting an event that happens over by the science, I believe it happens by the Science Museum in Balboa Park. It's an Ask an Atheist outreach event put on by selected members of the San Diego Coalition of Reason, and they're asking us to host it. And several of our people have been going to it, and I put it out that we would, you know, tentatively put it out just a couple times at first, every few weeks, to see if our membership liked it, and our membership liked it. So we're posting it now every week, and I hope that you can step down there because apparently they have some really good chats. Usually I'm busy putting the show together for Saturday night. I'm going to pop down occasionally, and I hope you can join us on Saturday morning at Balboa Park and Saturday evening at the Bamboo Lounge and Tea Deli. Well, this has been our third edition of San Diego Seculars. I hope you enjoy this. I will have a better edited one later. I just haven't had enough time. I apologize. I'm looking for a job. But hopefully I have one soon. Hopefully I can get this back weekly. It'll definitely be back next week. But have a great rest of your week. Be safe and onward and upward. Yours in Humanism, Jason Fry, and this has been a production of the Humanist Association of San Diego. Bye.